Chapter 15. Breaching the border of the preserve had a strangely comforting effect on Elith. She'd spent so long looking over her shoulder that voluntarily stepping into the lion's den made her feel like she'd seized the initiative. If the detail were still out hunting for her, then there would be fewer of them here to deal with. And if not, well, then at least they certainly wouldn't be expecting her. The intelligence she'd gleaned from the Authority archives had proved invaluable. Though incomplete, it had given her a sketch of the security measures she'd be facing. Her full infiltration suit rendered her invisible to most of what she would encounter, and smart movement and good field craft could handle the rest. The goal now was to reach Eth Amuin and extract from him the knowledge the house needed to move forward. Beyond that, well, there was no point in trying to see beyond that now, not when so much had already strayed so far from known paths. Her need for stealth forced a slow pace. She took 2.5 days to reach visual range of the target location. It was mid-afternoon when she arrived and proved her intuition correct. The site had some natural concealment, and additionally had a darkened, almost granular quality to it that suggested some additional tech-based masking was at work. But to Elith's trained eyes, the outlines and contours were plain enough. There, about 3/4 of the way up a ridge, lay a fortified compound where none should have been. She waited until dark to close the rest of the distance. When she finally reached a good point of observation, it became apparent why none of the orbital imaging had picked anything up. About 20 feet inside the outermost fence were an arrangement of tall, slender towers with bulbous heads. Diffusers. Simple devices that sampled the surrounding environment and projected an artificial canopy. The tech seemed misplaced in an area that otherwise blended so harmoniously with the natural surroundings. The compound, in fact, seemed at odds with everything else on the preserve. From her vantage, she could see that the structures closer to the center of the compound were older and more in line with those in the area around Hawk's cabin. But farther out from that center, the structures appeared newer, more intrusive. With an almost military bearing, at odds with the idyllic hillsides and glens. The compound itself was dauntingly arrayed. Whoever had designed it clearly had training in security, maybe even at a military level. There were 3 fences to get through. Each had several entry points, but there were only 2 gates that Elith could see that allowed direct travel through all of them. Both of those were well guarded. The others were arranged such that one would have to snake through from one entrance to the next in a tedious zigzag pattern with a good 20 yards of travel between each. Still, the place wasn't set up to repel a determined assault by a large force. It seemed more like a prison than a firebase. Access was controlled, all movement observed. But there were no air defenses, no bunkers, no ambush points, at least none she could observe. A prison, then, or perhaps a highly sensitive research facility. That, too, would fit the profile. If Eth Amuin was truly inside, then Elith understood why he had told her they weren't likely to see each other again. Now, the greater wonder was that he'd ever gotten out of the compound in the first place. There were no obvious patrols, though. Maybe the detail considered the place too remote or too secret to need active patrolling. As night deepened, the number of posted sentries dropped to a bare minimum. And though they were attentive, they had the posture of routine. Elith felt confident she could slip through unnoticed. Nevertheless, she waited in her hidden observation post a full day more, observing and taking note of the patterns of life within. Shortly before midday, she spotted what she was really looking for. Eth Amuin, crossing from the central building to one of the newer structures closer to the perimeter. He was escorted by 2 members of the detail, a man and a woman, both of whom Elith recognized from her brief encounter at Hawk's cabin. Seeing them now, though, within the greater context of her time on Quell, gave her a different perspective. They seemed as out of place as the diffusers had. They were dressed in local garb, but something in their bearing seemed disjointed, removed from the populace, embedded within it, but not of it. Hezra, or at least trained by the hierarchy. But for what? Protection of Eth Amuin? Or for his containment? Possibly both. Another layer peeled back to reveal only new, deeper questions. The Hezra, then, had to have been aware of Quell and its status, and so it would seem Eth Amuin's connection to it. Elith recalled her last conversation with the Paragon, specifically the Hezra Ka's startling confession before the Grand Council of the Deep Cutter Initiative's failure, and the Paragon's suspicion that it was merely the first move in a deeper game. Her discovery here seemed to confirm the Paragon's intuitions. The question now lay only in their motivation for concealing the matter, and the answer, Elith knew, would come from the same source she already sought. Eth Amuin reappeared later, as evening was coming on, and returned to the building in the center, which Elith took to be his residence. It was a small affair, set among a cluster of other structures. In front, a well-tended hedge guarded the door and lined a few feet of the walkway leading to it. This time, only one man accompanied him, and when the pair reached his home, they stood outside the entrance together for several minutes, continuing some conversation. The man was tall and thin, and had his shoulders hunched and head tilted forward, as though listening intently to whatever it was Eth Amuin was saying. The exchange seemed amicable, but also not of equals. The tall man's posture and demeanor showed submission, a student of the great wise man of the mountain. The strangeness of the circumstances again struck Elith. Eth Amuin didn't appear to be a prisoner exactly, though there had been no doubt from her earlier meeting with him that he also hadn't considered himself a free man. The conversation ended, and Eth Amuin entered his home and didn't come out again that night. About an hour after midnight, Elith decided to go visit. She cached all but her most essential gear, donned her mask and hood, and slipped from her observation point. The compound was well secured. Its gates were closed and locked, its fences tall and barbed. But overcoming such measures was second nature to Elith, by now perhaps even first. Having watched the full day's cycle, she had a good sense of where the personnel inside considered their security strongest. The sentries spent most of their attention on the main gates and the two entrances nearest the unbroken tree line. The access points with the most open ground to traverse created an assumption that anyone crossing those points would be easy to detect. Elith exploited that error. It took patience to penetrate the interior, but once there, she had almost free rein. The few eyes still open were all facing outward, and it took little effort for her to make her way to Eth Amuin's residence. The structure was a simple, two-floor home, not unlike Hawk's cabin, though in this case both floors were above ground. Elith clambered up the outside to a balcony. She peeked through the window into the room, saw that it was clear. After confirming the door wasn't wired for alarms, she made short work of the lock and eased her way in, closing the door behind her softly. For a time, she remained by the entry, listening. The interior was dark, save for the gentle moonlight spilling in from the few windows, and all was still and silent. Once her eyes had adjusted, Elith crept forward in a crouch with cat-quiet steps. The room she'd entered appeared to be a small study, with a pair of chairs against one wall and a work area opposite. She exited to the hall, and found that it was open to the floor below, with stairs farther to her right and a second room just beyond. That room, too, was dark. But down below, a soft orange glow illuminated the floorboards. Elith moved to the stairs and stole down them. They led to an open area, where sitting room and kitchen were divided only by a small island and a round table with two chairs. The light was coming from the partially open door of a room to one side. And through the crack, Elith could see Eth Amoin, sitting with his back to the door, bent over some work at a desk. Now that she was so close to her quarry, her heart rate bumped up. She wondered what his reaction would be to her presence and what response it would require from her. If he cried out, she would have to quiet him quickly. She hoped he wouldn't cry out. Watching him now, she remembered that first moment of waking to find him sitting in her room. This reversal of fortunes completed the circle for her. All that she had been through on Quell had led her here, prepared her for this moment, to confront this man from a position of knowledge and strength instead of being held at his mercy. She was still thinking of how best to make herself known when he turned his head and spoke over his shoulder.
"Hello, Eliah," he said. "I was hoping you'd come."
Chapter 16. There was no way he could see her. She was still too far, and his eyes too blinded by the light of the room to see through the veil of darkness that separated them. He turned back to his work, apparently neither surprised nor concerned by her sudden appearance.
"I was actually starting to think maybe you'd given up on me," he said, louder now, "or that something unpleasant had happened to you."
Elith remained where she was, perfectly still, to test his reaction. He continued to work for several moments, then turned around in his chair. She could see only half of his face through the cracked door. His eye didn't lock directly on her, but there was no doubt that he knew roughly where she was. She removed the mask and hood from her infiltration suit, moved forward, and pushed the door gently open. The room was his bedroom, and it was furnished simply, the bed still crisply made, despite the hour.
"I was hoping you'd be asleep," she said.
He smiled.
"If it's any consolation, I would have preferred it too, but sleep has been an elusive thing of late."
"Up every night, waiting for me?"
"Not you specifically, I don't think. But it does feel like waiting. And here I thought I'd left an impression on you." "Oh, well, of that there's no doubt," he said,
and then stood and turned fully to face her.
"You look tired, Eliah. Can I get you something to drink or eat? A place to sit, maybe?"
He had a slight smile on his face, but the concern and offer both seemed genuine.
"I'll rest after my work is done." "Ah, yes, your work," he said, nodding. "And that is what, exactly?"
Elith answered simply, "Correcting courses." "And I am in need of correction?"
"Probably," she said, "but my concern isn't for you, it's for Quell."
Eth Amoin seemed momentarily puzzled by that, but then said,
"You're sure I can't get you anything?"
He waited for her to reply. When she didn't, he sighed and crossed over to his bed to sit on it sideways, with his back against the wall, his legs out straight and crossed at the ankles.
"After all you've been through just to reach me," he said, "I find it hard to believe I'm not your primary reason for coming."
"I guess I shouldn't be surprised that you have such a high opinion of yourself," Elith said, "though I admit after our first meeting I'd hoped for a little humility."
"First impressions are funny that way. So strong. So rarely accurate. Somehow that never prevents us from putting our faith in them. I, for example, have been under the impression that you've been looking for me for a long time, though you may not have realized it. But I'm not clear on what you plan to do now that you've found me."
"I'm only here to find out what you and your people have done to this planet."
"My people have done very little other than care for it and nurture it, Eliah."
When he said her name, he made a small expression as though he'd tasted something bitter.
"I'm sorry. I can't keep calling you that."
"By my name?" He made a face at her, as though the false name had been meant for everyone else, but not for the two of them.
"Come now, it doesn't fit, and you know it. May I ask your real name?"
"You may ask."
"It's only fair, you already know mine."
"Eth Amoin," she said. "I'm not calling you that."
"Oh, why not?" because you talk too much. He opened his mouth, but then closed it, smiled again, and shrugged, like he'd been about to argue and decided instead to concede.
I did try to get them to call me Eth Enohem, but they didn't like that one.
Eth Enohem, the vanquished one. I don't know why, she said. It suits you better.
I thought so, he replied with a half shrug. But, well, here we are, both inadequately named. How shall we proceed?
Simply, I hope. You tell me all that you've done here on Quell, and then I leave.
All? That would take more time than either of us have.
I can tell you part of it. Your world is dying. I know you have a hand in that.
Dying, he said. I suppose it's possible, but if so, that would be a necessary part of rebirth. New growth from the ashes of a wildfire and all that.
At the mention of ashes, Elith's vision came vividly back to her mind, of clutching ash and bone. For a brief moment, a look passed over Eth Amoin's face as though he knew, as if he'd said it specifically to force her to recall the image.
There will be no rebirth for Quell, she said. It's too deeply broken. So was I, once.
That's apparent from your work. What is it you've done?
He shrugged, shook his head, as though he didn't know what to say, and then answered vaguely, I'm helping it find its voice.
Answer more specifically.
I can try, Eth Amoin said, but you aren't ready to hear. The gulf between us is too great, Alaya.
I've spoken to some of your followers. They've told me of your gift for teaching, how you can help them feel the truth of a thing. I believe you can do the same for me.
And why should I speak if there is no possibility of being understood?
Because you love this world. And I've come to love it as well.
She'd only said it to build rapport. But as the words left her mouth, she recognized they were not without truth.
We share that, she continued. He gazed at her for a few moments, evaluating.
Perhaps you understand now why I let them call me Eth Amuin.
I don't. He looked down at his hands folded in his lap.
Some truths cannot be heard, he said quietly now, no matter how clearly they are stated, and some cannot be spoken, no matter how deeply they are known.
There was something in the explanation, a reawakening of the same electric reaction she'd had when she'd first heard the title spoken by Ame. In the low language, Eth Amuin was simply the silent one. But his reply brought with it an echo of something deeper, more profound. The companion phrase, properly pronounced in the deep language, took on additional depth and dimension, and became something more akin to one who cannot be compelled by any means to break trust or reveal a secret, not merely one who chooses not to speak, but rather one who stands and refuses to answer, even under great personal pain. Elith knew then that this man, this Eth Amuin, had indeed glimpsed the boundless power of the cosmos and returned from it broken and lost.
I can help you, Elith said. I can help you find yourself again, but only after you answer me. I'd like to, he said, but I can't.
The truth was locked away somewhere within him, down amid the ruin of his thoughts. To plumb those depths, Elith knew she would have to reach once more with the deep language, to draw forth the answers he possessed that she desperately needed.
I can help you with that too, Elith said, and stretching out her hand toward him, she spoke the deep language to him.
Uncoiling the serpent, the technique combined the force of the dread with the connection of the communion, manifesting all of nature's glorious potential for creation and its terrible power to destroy. He would experience union with and terror before her, and would strive to gain her favor and to avoid her wrath. It would scar him, perhaps, in his damaged state, destroy him completely, but there was no other way. A wind moving over the deep. But even as the first words were forming on her lips,
Eth-Amuin closed his eyes and began motioning with his hands and muttering. Words she couldn't hear with tones in open intervals. A rapid series of notes punctuated by gestures. When she finished the declaration, he exhaled and held his hands spread before him, as though steadying himself. A few moments later, he opened his eyes, looking focused and slightly hurt.
"Finally, you are showing your true self to me. Thank you."
"I will answer your questions, Elia," he said, "but not like that." Elith tried not to let her face reveal the depths of the turmoil within her. As Quell had cast off her attempt to speak its doom, so this man had deflected her effort to penetrate his innermost thoughts. And his manner was unlike any she had known. Not the controlled, precise methods of the house, but rather something spontaneous, as though he had improvised it in the moment. He scooted forward on the bed and placed his feet on the floor, but did not stand.
"I don't blame you for trying," he said. "You are a student of the true speech."
The true speech, whether he had understood her exact words or not, wasn't clear. But he knew enough to recognize the sounds of the deep language for what they were. No man had ever been trained within the first house. Her use of the technique might not have marked her as an advocate. Small comfort, though, in the face of the revelation. He brightened then, nodded to himself.
"That's good. That means there's still hope. I believe I can teach you, but it will take some time."
"I'm a quick learner," she said.
"I don't doubt that you are, but no, I'm afraid it will take more than the time we have in this moment. And there must be conditions."
Conditions. She knew what those would be. Give herself up, to stay here on his preserve, to learn at his feet, to become his disciple.
"You must take me with you," he continued, "away from here, away from this place and these people."
The demand countered her every expectation.
"Away from your disciples?" she asked.
"I'm more of a student than a teacher," he said. "I don't have disciples, nor do I want them. I never have."
"Then who's out there?" Elith said, motioning in the general direction of all the people in the compound and beyond.
He looked toward the exterior wall, though there were no windows. Contemplated.
"I suppose they are of two kinds. People with questions, trying to learn how best to live their lives, and other people who believe they can use me for their own gain."
He returned his eyes to hers. "Both out there and in here."
"And which kind am I?"
"Both, maybe," he answered, "though perhaps more of one than the other. I haven't figured out where the balance lies, but no matter. I try to take people as they come, not as I would have them."
Elith didn't know what to make of the man.
Her every attempt to discern anything true about him seemed to slip past or through him, as Quell had bobbed away from her cosmic grasp. She wondered if this was the result of some quiet madness, the chaotic potential of the universe trapped within his psyche. There was no telling what he was capable of.
"And what will your people do when they find out you're gone?"
"They aren't my people," he said, with some heat to the words. "They're just people. And up until now, I've been content to live among them. But now I'd like to leave. And I would prefer to do so in the least dramatic way possible. With you." She had anticipated neither his resistance to the influence of the deep language, nor his apparent willingness to abandon his life on the preserve. She couldn't take him at his word, but his desire to escape the compound did seem genuine. The question, then, was what plan of his own was he trying to execute?
"Impossible," Elith said.
"Much is impossible until we are forced to find a way."
"I was trying to be polite," she said. "Not impossible, just highly undesirable."
"Not to me. I wasn't concerned about you."
You made that clear, he said. But you can obviously come and go more or less as you please. So just do that. Except with me.
I have many years of training and practice. I can't imagine what it'd be like trying to drag you along.
I bet you could if you tried.
You're right, I can. None of the outcomes are good. Aren't you in charge around here? Can't you just order them to let you go?
Sadly, no. It's not quite like that. I may not have the training you do, but I'm not bad in the woods. I can avoid being seen when I so desire.
Really? How many hours did it take them to find you at Hawk's cabin?
Oh, I guess about 3, he said with a smile. But I wasn't exactly hiding then.
And how often do you run away?
Rarely.
More than once?
Well, more than a few times, yes. Obviously, they've always found you.
True.
But I've never made a genuine attempt to prevent them from doing so.
Oh, pardon me. You let them catch you?
Yes. Eventually.
His claim wasn't reassuring. But a hidden advantage might have been buried in the otherwise discouraging facts. His detail wouldn't connect his disappearance to her, at least not immediately. That would expand their window of opportunity.
How long will it take them to notice you're missing?
How soon will we leave?
I haven't agreed to that.
Well, a few hours maybe. If I don't appear by midday, they'll come knocking. I don't imagine it will take long after that.
And how will they respond?
I suspect they'll check the usual places first. After that, the efforts will become more vigorous. If I'm not mistaken, I believe you've seen what it's like to have my so-called security detail chasing you down.
They're persistent, certainly. I was rather hoping they'd forgotten about me by now.
Eth Amuin shook his head. You killed 2 of their men.
In self-defense?
And sent their bodies back in their own ship. What kind of message did you expect that to send?
It wasn't intended as a message of any kind.
Interesting that you would know the true speech, and yet be so ignorant of what your actions might say, he said, smiling to soften the words.
If they didn't want the reply, they shouldn't have started the conversation.
Yes, well, nevertheless, their friends took that quite personally. I doubt they'll ever stop looking for you. They may pause, though, to look for me. And I should warn you. However intently you thought they've been hunting for you, it's nothing compared to the lengths they'll go to find me.
You aren't helping your case.
Only because I don't believe you have a choice.
Extracting the man from the compound was one thing. He had already proven capable of getting out on his own, so maybe the initial escape wasn't as impossible as it first appeared. Towing him along behind her for some unknown amount of time, though, with his detail fully switched on and solely focused on his return, was an entirely different matter. If she could get him off planet, however, and back to the Vaunt, there would be ample opportunity to investigate what he knew and how he had come to know it. If she couldn't kill Quell herself, perhaps presenting the means by which it could be accomplished was her best offering. And the opportunity to study the manner of his learning might be the key to understanding at last how the strain had spread and how to immunize the ascendants against it. To deliver such to the First House would indeed be a divine gift. Her time inside the compound was rapidly dwindling, and there seemed to be no way now to extract the knowledge she needed. She would have to take the vessel of that knowledge along with her until she could determine how to pry it open or deliver it to those who could.
What assurance do I have that you won't betray me?
None, he said, other than the fact that I haven't done so already. But I've been waiting for you for a long time, Elia. I have no intention of wasting the moment.
Nothing about the situation seemed right, but then that had been the case almost since the moment she'd entered the planet's atmosphere. And as Eleth stood there, in this man's bedroom, she once again felt the walls of inevitability closing in on her. There was no choice other than to do what was necessary to complete the mission or abandon it, guided by the true star.
Eleth Anuel,
her dream voice had called her. Waymaker.
I'll give you 5 minutes to collect your things, she said. I won't feed you or clothe you, and if the time comes where I have to choose between escaping together or alone, I won't hesitate to leave you behind.
Truly, you are a gracious soul.
Elith stepped out of the bedroom, once more shrouding herself in darkness, and then returned to the upper level, where she could look out the windows and plan her route out. She'd planned to go out the back, down from the balcony. Evaluating it now, she wondered if her new charge would fall and break his ankle immediately, or if he'd wait to do that somewhere out in the wilderness. 4.5 minutes later, Eth Amuin reached the top of the stairs, dressed in mismatched clothes of darker hues and carrying a worn satchel over one shoulder. He'd avoided wearing black, choosing instead earth tones that would blend well with the surroundings in both day and night. And Elith was pleased to see he had sense enough not to bring along anything obviously useless, or if he had, at least it was concealed in the bag.
Traveling light? She said.
I don't need much, he replied. That's the first encouraging thing I've heard you say.
Now that we're traveling companions, I don't suppose you'll tell me your name.
Not until you tell me yours.
It doesn't matter, I suppose, he said. If you can't bring yourself to use my name, then whatever I am to you, that is what you may call me.
Misfortune, then. Or burden. Maybe grief.
Grief, he said, and chuckled. Grief sounds right, the way you say it.
And then the lightness left his voice, and his words took on a heavier note. And I think it might prove true enough in the end. You have a secret tunnel, or invisible ship we could use?
Usually I just go out the front door.
I was afraid of that, Elith said. She followed him back to ground level and to the main entrance of his home. The front door was framed with two narrow windows on either side, and looking through them, Elith saw now how the front door was obscured from casual ground level observation by the alignment of the hedge and the neighboring structures. From this view, it actually was the safest way out. She slipped the hood of her infiltration suit back over her head and affixed her mask. If they see you, don't assume they've seen me.
I'll follow your lead.
Good policy, she replied. Before they departed, she taught him a few hand signs. He picked them up quickly, able to run through the entire sequence after seeing each only once. More importantly, he seemed to grasp immediately the importance of each and how they might be used.
So let's say you had gone ahead of me, he said, and then wanted me to move around behind you because you had just spotted 2 sentries. That would go something like...
He strung together a series of signals, a combination she had not expressly taught him, well-paced and articulated, that communicated exactly that intention.
That's right, she replied, trying not to sound impressed, but I don't plan on getting too far away from you. Unless you're leaving me behind.
Right.
Got it.
Elith turned to the door and drew a deep breath.
Don't worry, Eth Amuin said. I won't let you down.
I doubt that, she answered. And with a world full of enemies ahead of her and certain trouble in tow, Elith opened the door and stepped forth. Chapter 17. Elith's initial apprehension at bringing Eth Amuin along with her was eased somewhat within the first few minutes of traveling with him. He was exceptionally quiet, almost as quiet as Elith herself, and showed both good instincts and sharp awareness of his surroundings. Perhaps more to her surprise, he seemed perfectly content to trail along behind her, following her every move and reacting immediately to her few commands. Only at one point did he dissent with her direction, but it proved to be for good cause. His suggestion took them to a shallow depression in the land that made the crossing to the tree line less risky. Once they made the wilderness, she returned to her previous observation point to collect her gear, and then pushed the pace to open as much distance between them and the compound as they could before dawn. After 5 miles, Elith realized she'd been going even harder than she would have had she been alone. Subconsciously, perhaps, hoping to force Eth Amuin into such a pace so as to make him give up. But he made no complaints. Even better or worse, depending on her perspective, the challenging terrain and fast pace didn't seem to be fazing him at all. It hadn't occurred to her before, but now that she'd been able to observe how he moved through the wild, it made complete sense. The man had spent untold years on the mountain, and his love for the natural had been apparent in the cultivation surrounding him. He had an intuitive sense of the space around him and his place in it, and whenever he stopped moving, his stillness was so complete it was as though he had become part of the landscape. It wasn't hard to imagine him in a fairy tale vision, sitting on a rock somewhere, with birds perched on his head and shoulders, and fawns grazing at his feet. By the time morning had fully arrived, they had traveled just over 7 miles, a wide enough buffer that Elith felt comfortable with taking a brief break to rest and plan their next steps. The morning air thawed beneath the rays of the sun and lost some of its edge. She had Eth Amuin sit by a tree while she climbed a nearby rocky shelf to get a better view. They were still on the mountainside, though lower down now. As it turned out, the elevation didn't help all that much, given the height and density of the surrounding trees. Still, Elith lingered there, collecting her thoughts, preparing her mind, and watching Eth Amuin sitting by his tree. He had his legs stretched out in front of him, crossed at the ankles, with his hands folded in his lap and his head leaning back against the tree. His eyes were closed, but she got the impression he wasn't resting so much as he was using every sense except his sight to take in his surroundings. She sat down on the rock, dangled her legs over the edge, and pulled out her nav tracker to start considering how best to escape beyond the border of the preserve. The last time she'd done it, it had been aboard one of the detail skimmers. She wished she had that option again, though without the trouble that had come along for the ride before. They were making good time, but she wasn't comfortable with the idea of trying to make it all the way out on foot. The first few hours were the most critical. The longer they could stay out, the wider the potential search area became. Looking at the tracker, she could see two different clusters of structures within 5 miles. If they were housing for more of Eth Amuin's security forces, she would skirt between them. But she remembered the effect Eth Amuin's presence had had on Hawk and Ame. If those buildings contained more of his followers, or whatever they considered themselves to be, then it was likely he could ask for whatever he wanted. She hopped down from her perch. "Grief," she said. He opened his eyes and looked over at her. "Come here." He sat forward to stand, but then paused abruptly as though startled. A moment later, he reached out slowly and picked something up off his legs. At first, Elith took it to be a twig. When it moved in his hand, she realized it was, in fact, a slender, green-black snake. Apparently, it had crawled onto him and then stopped to enjoy the warmth. But given the earlier image she'd had of him with songbirds and deer, the appearance of the reptile put a sinister twist on the motif. He laid the snake gently to one side as he stood, and then wiped his hands off on his jacket as he walked over to join her. "Cute fellow," he said, "but better from a distance." "I figured you were the sort to appreciate every creature," Elith answered. "Every creature in its place, yes. Snakes and spiders belong where I am not." His light humor caught her off guard, but she suppressed the reflexive chuckle, not wishing to encourage anything but serious focus in that moment. Instead, she just held out her tracker for him to see. "We're here," she said, pointing to the marker in the center. Then she indicated the two separate clusters of structures. "What are these? Here and here?" Eth Amuin cocked his head to one side while he looked at the top-down view, orienting himself. "Oh, this one's the Telos Collective. 40 people or so, maybe. Nice folks." He looked to the other point and shook his head. "That one's no good." "More of your detail?" "No, but the people there are somewhat misaligned." "These Telos people, they have a ship you could borrow?" "Not that I'm aware of. If I remember correctly, they have a bunch of striders. I haven't been out there in a while, though." "Locked up?" Eth Amuin shrugged.
If so, I suspect they'd unlock them if I asked nicely.
And would they report you to the detail?
They would if someone came asking, I guess. But I don't think they'd raise any alarms, if that's what you mean.
Well, unless you go in looking like that.
Like what?
Like someone who came here to kidnap me.
Elith hadn't thought much about how her infiltration gear might make her look, since the whole point of it was not to be seen wearing it. She removed the mask and laid back the hood. How about now?
Better, he said, smiling. Almost like you belong.
The warmth and kindness of his smile felt genuine, and the subtle emotional effect warned her to keep her guard up. He was prodding her gently, but with purpose. Again, she kept the focus on the task at hand. She checked the distance. The collective was about 3 miles out. The amount of ground they could cover in a couple of frames would more than make up for the slight detour. And though substantially slower than a skimmer, they would have the benefit of being able to stay beneath the cover of the wilderness.
All right, she said. Keep up.
They moved out together, and she resumed her previous pace. In some of the tougher sections, Eth Amuin lagged behind, but she didn't slow for him, and to his credit, he always managed to make up the ground. They reached the outskirts of the collective about an hour later, both breathing hard and dripping sweat despite the coolness of the morning. The houses and outbuildings had been grouped more tightly together than the ones she'd seen back where Hawk's cabin was, but she could tell the same general philosophy was at work. Though the living quarters all seemed comfortable enough, none stood out as obviously overbuilt or extraneous. Each had been built with a purpose to which it was well suited. The unification with the surroundings was neither as complete nor as finely tuned here, but the concern for preservation was apparent, and attempts had been made to minimize impact. This collective had a different set of priorities and trade-offs, perhaps, but the goals being pursued were clearly similar. Several people were out and about, some working, others chatting with friends and neighbors. Elith remained inside the woods for several minutes, observing.
So, Eth Amuin finally said, now what?
That was precisely what Elith was trying to figure out. She hadn't yet spotted anyone using a frame, nor had she seen any in the open. If there were any still in the collective, they weren't lying around for the taking.
You're sure they've got striders here?
I told you it had been a while, but let's go see.
He was up and tramping toward the people before she could stop him, and his sudden motion drew the immediate attention of a few of the residents. There was nothing more for Elith to do then but follow him. Still, she kept some distance open between them to preserve her wider view of the situation and to increase the time she had to react in case things went wrong. As to be expected, the initial reaction was surprise and defensiveness, a natural response for anyone seeing two strangers appear out of the woods near their home. Quickly, though, recognition rippled through the people, and their reaction echoed Hawk and Ame's, a quiet mixture of astonishment and submission. Eth Amuin strode toward them, waving as though these people were his longtime neighbors. As it turned out, he apparently knew them better than he had let on.
Birnin, he said, calling a nearby man by name. How are you, my friend? You're looking well. Shoulder all healed up?
The man stared blankly for a moment, then dipped his head.
Yes, sir, fully recovered and doing very well, thank you, sir. And you?
Fine, fine, thank you.
He closed in on the little group of friends that had been chatting. Elith held back, allowing the distance to grow between them and keeping to the edges of the collective, staying only close enough to monitor what he was saying. He spent several minutes talking to the individuals gathered, asking each about some specific detail of their lives. For a man who hadn't been among them for some time, he seemed to know a great deal about them, and his concern for them genuine. A few of the people cast glances in Elith's direction, but thankfully Eth Amuin didn't attempt to introduce her. Easier to let them assume she was part of his security detail, undoubtedly. She was certainly content to play the part of disinterested bodyguard. Finally, after spending what she considered far too much time socializing, He got to the point. We've been out getting the lay of the land, but it's taking longer than I was expecting. I was just wondering if you might have any old striders lying around that we could borrow.
I do, Birnen answered quickly. Happy for you to take them as long as you need them, sir.
Is it going to cause you any hardship? Eth Amuin asked.
Oh, no, none at all.
Then I'd be happy to accept, if you're certain.
Of course, it's a privilege to offer. They're in my storehouse. Let me get my boys to help me get them for you.
No, that's fine. We'll walk with you.
Eth Amuin followed Birnen away from the rest of the group, waving for Eleth to come along. He seemed to have picked up on her ruse and was playing along by treating her as if she were at his command. A few minutes later, Birnen had his storehouse open and was showing them how to strap into the frames. They were rugged and well-used, and heavier than the ones Hawk and his crew had been running. These looked like they'd been used more for harvesting and hauling than for ranging over the terrain. The striders likely weren't as fast as the others, but there was no question they would still greatly increase the pace of progress. Birnen gave them a few pointers and reassured Eth Amuin repeatedly that there was no rush on returning them. Though she'd initially taken his claim that it was no trouble at face value, at his continued insistence, Eleth began to gather the idea that the loss of his frames was going to be a significant burden to this man and his family. Nevertheless, Eth Amuin accepted the offer gladly and gave no hint of his intent to return them. She couldn't tell whether he realized what a sacrifice Birnen was making. If he didn't, it made him seem particularly oblivious. If he did, it made him seem somehow especially cruel. Once they were strapped in and ready to go, Eth Amuin made a brief return to the open area where more of a crowd had gathered. Eleth let him go on his own, in hopes that by waiting near their point of departure, her impatience would encourage him to keep his goodbyes brief. Whether he took notice of her or not, he was gone only a few moments before he returned to her. They set out from the collective, taking a southeasterly route that would lead them to the nearest point of the border, a few miles distant. Crossing the border was itself no simple matter. For a stretch of 300 yards or so inside the boundary, a sensor network kept constant vigil. Eleth had passed through the network before with the aid of the intelligence she'd gathered, her infiltration suit, and her instincts. Getting back out with Eth Amuin was going to require a different approach, and quite likely more direct measures. She was still puzzling through how best to bypass the sensors about 2 miles out from the border when they heard the ships approaching, a low growling among the ridges behind them, rapidly closing in and gaining a vicious edge. Eleth motioned swiftly to a nearby clump of trees, and they bounded under the cover of the dense canopy. The harsh noise grew to a screaming roar as the skimmers tore the sky above them, passing somewhere farther north. Eleth scanned the slivers of sky she could see, but was unable to spot the vessels. She could tell from the wall of sound that there were multiple ships moving fast, but their number and distance were both lost in the chaotic tumble and merging of the echoes among the mountains. The velocity suggested a known destination, not a search. She wasn't sure whether that was good news or bad. The two remained sheltered under their improvised cover until the sound had died in the hills. Right on time, Eth Amuin said, once all had settled. It was still only late morning.
A little early, Eleth said. You said midday. Close enough.
Close enough gets you killed.
Any guess which of your usual places they're going to check?
He made a face. They're not headed to one of your usual places?
They might be, he said.
After a pause, he added,
but they would be taking an unusual route to get there.
Eleth sighed heavily and turned her back to him to face the direction the ships had gone. This wasn't going to work. Alone, she could make it. But with this man in tow, her confidence was rapidly approaching zero.
Shouldn't we keep moving? Eth Amuin asked.
Perhaps there was still a way to retrieve the information she needed. Maybe her mistake before had been giving him time enough to react. She inhaled deeply
and scanned their surroundings as though evaluating the area for a new path.
Yes, she said, turning to face him. You're right, we should.
She looked off through the trees, motioned toward a hollow some distance below them.
We'll cut back this direction?
Down through there, you see?
He turned his head to follow her gesture. In that instant, Elith struck.
Open hand across the throat, then her fist into his solar plexus, stunning his diaphragm and briefly evacuating his lungs. He crumpled around the blow, staggered back a step, and Elith spoke. Again, as the words of the deep language left her mouth, Eth Amuin responded with a series of gestures. This time, however, robbed of the power to speak, he could only groan some guttural syllables, meaningless and empty. Or so she thought. But just as before, she felt the power of the deep language glance off him, turned aside by some kindred force, both strange and familiar. For a moment after, he stood there with his head down, hand over his chest where she'd struck him, struggling to compose himself. Once he did, he looked up, a snarling flash in his eyes, a wolf crouched and poised to pounce.
Alaya,
he said quietly and rasping, and then straightening up again.
Alaya.
His voice louder, clearer, not a shout, but a declaration with authority, one that, despite its bare volume, nevertheless seemed to roll the hills with thunder. A black wave struck Elith then, something neither physical nor intangible, immaterial but still substantial, as though all the weight of a 1,000-pound stone had passed through her. It forced her back, and she fell to the ground under its power. Terror came with it, a moment of abject panic. She was stunned, immobilized, completely at his mercy. He crossed to her, stood over her. She prepared herself for the blow. And then,
Elia.
The sound of sunlight, a golden warmth, a vibrant call to life. Elith looked up at the being who seemed now to tower, his hand extended down to her, to raise her up.
Let's be friends, he said,
his voice now only what it had been before, his form nothing more than that of a man, and one slightly built at that. Elith felt her strength return, and anger replace her fear. She got to her feet without his aid, facing him, confronting him. Though she didn't know what to say or do in that moment, she stared back at him, defiant.
It will be better for everyone, he said, and everything around us.
His eyes shifted from hers to just beside her, looking beyond. She was reluctant to take her eyes off him, but gradually her resolve slipped away and she turned her head to look behind her and caught her breath. A shallow depression extended for 25 feet from where she stood. The earth compressed beneath the surge, leaves, needles, and debris scattered from the forest floor along the trail, tree limbs broken and dangling in its wake. She turned back to face him, horrified.
That was a bit more than I intended, he said, but I don't know your real name and I wanted to make sure you could hear me.
Elith wanted to understand what the man had just done, how he had invoked and wielded power in that manner. She might even have asked if she had been able to find the words to do so, but the depth of her bewilderment and the magnitude of her indignation prevented her. She had provoked the attack, it was true, but his callous disregard for collateral damage reminded her of why the man was not only her enemy, but also that of the entire Ascendance. The physical effect on their surroundings was apparent. But what impact might ripple throughout the cosmic fabric was unknown and unknowable. And he had done it without a single thought.
I told you I would teach you, he continued, and I meant it. But you must be patient. I will not submit myself to the teaching of unbridled chaos, she spat. Then I fear you will be ill-equipped for what lies ahead, he answered,
in a calm but foreboding tone. His mood had turned dark once more, as he fell into his persona of doomsayer, visionary prophet of the end times. We're in the becoming now, Eliah. All foundations will shake, brought upon this world by your own hand. He shook his head. Whether you see it or not, we are aligned in purpose. And if we are separated or captured before I share with you what I have learned, then it's possible nothing will stand against that which is to come. And what is that? This great and terrible doom, bearing down upon us all, yet somehow glimpsed only by you? Eth Amuin opened his mouth, but then closed it again, and a sadness alighted upon him. Let me guess. That's a truth that cannot be heard, no matter how clearly stated. No, he said. It's the other kind. Unspeakable. But that, only for the moment. And as quickly as the darkness had come over him, it once again retreated. He looked at her as though she'd never struck him, or he, whatever it was he'd done. I know it's asking a lot, Eliah, but I need you to trust me. Can you find it in yourself to do that? No, Elith scoffed. That apparently was all she could do. She could neither trust him nor abandon him, at least not yet. Twice now, he had used some unknown technique to empower himself, though he may not have realized it. Each time had provided her an opportunity to observe and to learn. Perhaps given enough time, she would not need his willing participation to find what she sought.
Well, at the very least, then, may I suggest that you not do that again? A second time and my response might not be quite so restrained.
You can suggest whatever you want, she said, refusing to let the threat register. Come on, we're losing time. Elith didn't wait for a response before she turned her back on him. In less than 2 miles, she would be busy navigating the preserve's sensor network. Beyond that, none could say, for now there was only forward. She led the way down the ridge to the hollow and followed it the remaining distance to the border. And though she didn't turn back to look at his progress, Elith could tell from Eth Amuin's footfalls that he was less steady than he'd been before she'd tested him. Whatever method he had used to wield the power of the deep language had taken some toll on him. Clearly, she had underestimated the measure of power in the man. She wondered just how much of his capacity he had actually revealed. Perhaps she'd already experienced the height of it, and his threat had been merely bluster. Though if the Paragon had been correct, and the strain at work in Quell was due to some distant variation of Varen Fedek's original corruption, then it was possible she'd not yet discovered the depth of Eth Amuin's might. That thought sent a shiver through her, for fear she might be hopelessly outmatched. In such case, she had to consider that, rather than merely extracting information from him, she might instead need to smuggle him off-world, back to the Vaunt, maybe even to face the Paragon herself. For a fleeting moment, that thought triggered another. Perhaps the Paragon already knew all these things, and was in fact counting on them for some greater purpose. And for all the chaos and randomness of the events she'd experienced on Quell, Elith couldn't escape the feeling that even now a many-layered game was being played, and somehow she had become its most exposed pawn.